Okay, this is Victor Cunicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is June 18, 2010. The time is approximately 9:30 a.m. I'm accompanied by Brad Bondi, Ron Borzakowski, and Karen Dubas of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, and several individuals via telecon. We are at the FCIC for the interview of Stephanie Muddick and Lila Wingard of J.P. Morgan Bank. This interview will be... Excuse me?
I'm sorry to interrupt, Victor. Did you say there are several other individuals other than the ones you named that are on the line?
You.
Oh, okay.
You plural.
Thanks.
Okay.
We're here. Okay, keep going.
This interview will be recorded with the consents of Ms. Muddick and Wingard. Ms. Muddick, Ms. Wingard, could I get your verbal assent for the record?
Yes, and just wanted you to know that my name is pronounced Muddick.
Muddick,
but
thank
that's
you.
My assent. Fine with me. It's Lila Wingard.
Okay. At the conclusion, will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record and spell your last name for the transcriptionist. In the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute, Public Law 111-21, and signed into law by the President. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It's charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with completing a report of findings to the President and Congress by 15 December 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I can provide a copy of the statute by which the commission was formed if you so desire. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States, and the FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code, Section 1001, concerning false statements. I'm going to ask at this time that everybody spell their name. Cunicelli is C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I. Mr. Bondi?
Brad Bondi from the FCIC. It's B-O-N-D-I.
Mr. Borzakowski?
Ron Borzakowski, FCIC. B-O-R-Z-E-K-O-W-S-K-I.
Ms. Dubas?
Karen Dubas from the FCIC. D-U-B-A-S.
And Ms. Carey, if you could get your people to bring come in.
Sure. Jessica Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, Paul Weiss.
Jay Balachek, B-A-L-A-C-E-K, J.P. Morgan.
Kalisha Armand, I'll spell those. K-E-L-E-S-H-A, last name Armand, A-R-M-A-N-D.
Lila Wingard, W-I-N-B-A-R-D, J.P. Morgan Chase.
Stephanie Muddick, J.P. Morgan Chase, M-U-D-I-C-K.
Okay, excellent. Just a couple of ground rules. If you guys could allow us to finish questions before you start your answers, it'll make for a better transcript. If you're unsure about what we're asking for, please ask for a clarification, and we'll try and make ourselves more clear. You were good enough, Ms. Carey, to send along some bio information, so I won't ask any bio at the outset. What I'd like to do is maybe just have Ms. Muddick or Ms. Wingard tell us a bit about J.P. Morgan's commitment to Community Reinvestment Act, and if they could tell us a bit about their CRA program at J.P. Morgan.
Sure. This is Lila Wingard. J.P. Morgan has a longstanding commitment to outstanding performance under the Community Reinvestment Act. We run our CRA program in conjunction with our lines of business partners who actually deliver products and services across our bank footprint, and are cognizant of the fact that we are committed to serving all segments of the market, including low and moderate income communities or people. I manage our CRA program by working with our line of business partners across various areas within the bank that provide loans, investments, retail banking services, etc.
Okay. How large is your CRA department? How many full-time employees?
My team is 25 people. Most of them are people who do data analysis and performance analysis type work. I also have a team of four people within that who also help me in managing our relationships with community partners. In terms of the delivery of products and services that would be considered under our CRA evaluations, those staff are housed within our various lines of business and deliver those products along with to the lower income communities as well as to a broader base of communities, as I described earlier, across our footprint. They are not designated special people, if you will.
Okay.
It's a part of the way we do business.
Okay. Could you tell me a bit about the reporting structure of your department? To whom do you report?
I report to Stephanie Mudick, who is sitting here.
Okay. And what line does that? How does that line go up through executive management?
Sure. We report up to Bill Daly, who is vice chairman and head of corporate responsibility for JPMorgan Chase. And Bill reports to Jamie Dimon.
Okay, excellent. Tell me, JPMorgan's philosophy on CRA. I mean, I don't imagine. Are you proactive or reactive in CRA? Is this a duty or an obligation? Could you run that down for me?
I would say that we are proactive on activities that would be considered under CRA. To the extent that we are proactive on our non-CRA eligible activities, if you will, we pride ourselves on delivering high quality products and services to our customer base and our communities across all income and geographic segments, and this is no different than the way we deliver non-CRA eligible activity.
May I just add to that? We obviously take our responsibilities under CRA seriously, and compliance and performance with respect to our statutory responsibilities is a priority of ours across the company, irrespective of what the source of those obligations are. As Leela mentioned, we provide products and services to a pretty wide variety of customer segments, and the low and low mass or mass customer segment is one of a number of segments across our various lines of consumer businesses. So, and when we think about providing products and services to them, we think about how to provide the best products and provide, depth and distribution across this particular segment as well as the rest of our segments.
Excellent. I guess which leads me to my next question. If you see them as just other quality products and whatnot, I mean, do you basically look at these products as, hey, this is just other banking we're doing that maybe the federal government looks at differently, and we need to track in a different way because of this statute?
If I understand your question correctly, I would say that it's important for us probably to note to you that for the most part, we do not have special products
right, for
CRA.
Okay.
So the products that we have are products that are available to the masses. What makes them CRA product, if you will, is that the product is being utilized by
a borrower whose income falls within the CRA statutory guideline of being at less than 80% of the median income for the geographic area in which they live.
Okay.
So it's not something special or different that we've created for CRA. In most situations, it is simply that the borrower or the community in which that activity is taking place is at a lower income level.
Right.
But the loans are tracked in order that we may report them under our reporting obligations.
Right. And I guess question, maybe you can clarify something in my mind. I don't have 100% a great picture of it, and maybe you could clarify it for me. I don't think there's necessarily this one-to-one that a CRA qualifying, say, mortgage loan is necessarily a subprime loan. Is that J.P. Morgan's assessment?
No, J.P. Morgan's, let me see if I can rephrase this. It is our, a CRA loan and a subprime loan are two totally different things, if you will.
Right.
Again, a CRA loan, the way we define it, would be a loan that would be reportable in a CRA exam as having been made to someone whose income is under 80% or whose, for where the funds are being utilized, is a community whose income is less than 80% of the median.
Okay.
Subprime is a term that defines the risk basis, if you will, of a transaction. So it will be priced, risk-based pricing, maybe higher price,
right.
Not limited to any group of people. They come from, subprime loans are made to people across all economic spectrums.
Excellent. Now, sometimes in some literature, the subprime and CRA are kind of used indistinguishably. I just wanted you to tease that out for me. All right. Can you track profitability of your CRA loans as a group?
It is not something that we do as a normal course of our tracking process, if you will. There have been periodically efforts undertaken to identify loans that were made in certain communities or to borrowers at different income tranches and compare performance on that basis. But tracking financial performance of CRA loans or loans that are eligible under for CRA consideration versus loans that are not is not something that I do normally.
Okay, it's not your normal day-to-day that you would track the profitability of the CRA portfolio?
Correct.
Okay. Would that be because as you said earlier, they're not a different product, so they'd be tracked just as product on the portfolio?
They'd correct. Be so it's not a standalone, there's not a separate CRA portfolio, if you will.
Right. Okay.
There are loans within our portfolio made to borrowers at different income levels. Loans that would be considered under a CRA examination would be loans to borrowers at lower income levels, but it's the same product that we would offer, you know, to the public at large, regardless of income level.
Okay. What benefits has your CRA department brought or CRA compliance brought to J.P. Morgan?
I think you sort of hit it on the head when you described compliance. We have a responsibility to provide certain information to our regulators with respect to loans and we are examined for CRA compliance. So we have a department that the purpose of which is to make sure that we have processes in place and to monitor our ongoing performance in order to figure out whether we need to be doing more or less in various MSAs in order to ensure that we get at least a satisfactory rating on our exam, because it is important to us as an institution that we satisfy our regulatory responsibilities. And that's really the purpose of the function.
Okay. Is, you know, you mentioned function. Is, in your estimation, and I guess when I say you, I mean J.P. Morgan, is the CRA functioning as Congress intended it to your opinion? Could it be improved?
The statutory intent, as I understand it, was to ensure that financial institutions were proactive in the provision of financial services to all communities, including low and moderate income communities, with a focus on access to credit and access to retail banking facilities or branches, if you will, and so that those communities were not underserved. And so I believe that it is functioning as intended, in that it ensures that we, as insured depository institutions, keep our eye on the ball and make sure that we are sensitive to the needs of various segments of the marketplace.
Okay. The second.
I'm just going to add one other point, which is when CRA really came into existence, the level of access to credit and to banks generally in low and moderate income communities was significantly less than it is today, 30 plus years later, and so it's not clear whether the presence of the banking industry in those communities, by its terms, is a direct correlation. But it is certainly clear that accessibility to bank products and services for historically underserved communities has changed dramatically in the last 25 or 30 years, and that banks consider these communities to be legitimate and attractive sources of revenue to a much greater extent today than may have been the case, pre-CRA.
Okay. Recently, I had the benefit of meeting with a CRA advocate, and he voiced some things that I've seen from the advocate community. And I'd like to throw maybe a few things that he said past you and just get your feedback or your perspective from the banking community on it. he said that in the last 10 years he's seen a pattern where there have been periods in which there's a frenzy of mergers and acquisitions. 1998, 2004, large mergers, large acquisitions, and that in those times, banks become more interested in throwing out some commitments to CRA and saying, you know, here, so that we can merge, look what we'll do, we'll commit to this. Are banks more likely at those times to throw out large commitments in order to grease the skids on a merger? Or is your position that J.P. Morgan is consistently trying to work in the community and afford the benefits of home ownership and the CRA to the LMI community?
I would say in response to that J.P. Morgan Chase is consistently working to try to meet the needs of low and moderate income communities, whether there's a merger underway or not. But it's also not coincidental that when there is an announcement of a large transaction, that community advocates sometimes become concerned around what will this mean for their community. Will there be a decrease or an increase in the provision of services to their communities, and will often approach financial institutions to voice those concerns?
Is it a lot more common that J.P. Morgan gets approached around the time of an acquisition than otherwise by these community advocates?
No, it is not. We have an ongoing dialogue with community advocates with or without a merger, but the nature of the conversation around a time of a merger transaction may be more specifically directed around what will the merger mean to them. Will there be a change in commitment to serve certain communities? Any public announcement or commitment that's made during that time period or has been made during that time period in the past by J.P. Morgan Chase was not done for the purpose of greasing the skids of a merger application, as I think you described it, but more in terms of making proactive statements to help our community partners understand or feel comfortable that we remain committed to doing the good work that we've been doing in the past.
Okay. That was my phrasing, but I was paraphrasing someone else. Inartfully, but I was paraphrasing. Let me see, find my place here. Would you, I think you said rather well that, I guess maybe, I don't know, I'll paraphrase you and you tell me if I've got it right, that you try and have an ongoing dialogue with these community advocates, but I guess the tenor of it changes a bit. They're a little more concerned around the time of these mergers and acquisitions?
Oftentimes, the conversation, and I wouldn't say the tenor necessarily, but the focus, the concerns, when two institutions come together, there is a question about what does that mean for the community. For example, if the two institutions had historically served the same marketplace, will there be a change in the strategy on how the marketplace is served when two large parties come together? If the entity that is acquiring another is new to a marketplace, getting to understand the new entities, the new parent company's strategy and approach towards serving underserved communities. So how is this going to impact that particular organization's constituency or backyard?
Okay. How would you characterize the working relationship with these community advocate groups? Would you say you were working in concert, or would you characterize it more as you're in, you know, two parties with you know, some common interests and some that diverge that are engaged in give and take?
I think the latter would be the most accurate. Some common interests, sometimes a divergence or a difference of opinion on what is the most effective way for us to serve communities and help meet community needs. So what's most important to us at J.P. Morgan Chase is that we have an ongoing relationship, an ongoing dialogue, so that we can understand the needs of the community from the community perspective, and then work on ways that fit within good business practice, as we describe it, as we define it here at Chase, that we can help to address those needs.
Okay. Has J.P. Morgan ever worked with community advocates that were closer to the former characterization, much, you know, working very much in concert with you on some of these?
So, yes, we work with a large number of nonprofit organizations, some of which I would characterize more as nonprofits that are less active in advocacy and public policy, if you will, and more in devising programs to deliver on the ground, so working on financial education program delivery in concert with the bank, what have you. There are others who have a stronger focus on advocacy and on pushing for change. And then there are some who are kind of in the middle. They do a little bit of advocacy and they do some program development. We work with all three of those types of organizations.
Have you ever had any circumstances with some of these groups who are more on the fringe and have offered protests or picketing or something if J.P. Morgan didn't offer a greater commitment?
Do you have any organizations in mind that you're thinking about?
Not at all. I'm just trying to get a gauge of how much you work in concert and how much it can go to the other extreme.
I think there are organizations that we partner with, if you will, in the ways that Linda described, and there are organizations that we engage with, which I wouldn't really characterize necessarily as partnering with. They approach us, they raise questions to us, they approach various other stakeholders, which could include, congressmen, local, government officials, regulators, the OCC has an office which advocates routinely access in order to give their opinions about J.P. Morgan's CRA performance and general presence in the communities. Some are more vocal and more active than others. We have certainly had the experience of having organizations protest in and around our branches or raise questions at our annual meetings, and try to receive some answers about the way we do business, etc.
Okay, thank you. In talking with the community advocate, the gentleman mentioned some of the things they try and do in working with banks. Preeminent in his mind, one of the things that he was after was agreements. He saw, I guess, a community group as having more control if there was a signed agreement with the bank rather than the bank just making a unilateral commitment. Has J.P. Morgan engaged in both signed agreements under CRA and understanding they're all agreements and not enforceable, but signed agreements and just unilateral commitments?
So the answer, I believe, is yes. Let me just clarify. When you say unilateral commitment?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Where J.P. Morgan maybe will pledge, $300 million in a certain census tract in, LMI loans. Not as a signatory to an agreement or anything.
Okay, I understand that. So, yes, J.P. Morgan Chase or its predecessors has done some of both of those types of things you just described. However, signed agreement is not something we typically do and have not done in the more recent years. When CRA first came into being, almost 30 years ago, or a little more than 30 years ago now, agreements were seen as being a way, or a more common mechanism that community groups use to try to forge partnerships with banks or to gather an understanding as to what the institution would be doing in providing services to underserved communities. a lot of organizations and banks have now evolved to where it's more common to have partnerships to talk about performance with the, in the absence of a signed agreement. On the more unilateral agreement that you refer to, or commitment, we here refer to those as public commitments, which do not involve a signing with any third party, nonprofit or government or what have you. It's really a statement made voluntarily by the bank in a public space around our aspirational goals for providing access to credit or other types of financial products or branches, what have you, to communities that are often thought of or seen as being underserved.
Okay. A couple of questions that I again, haven't really gotten to gel in my mind, and so I apologize if it's not that well formed, but I'm interested in the how banks get credit for CRA loans that maybe they didn't originate themselves, if they purchased them, and that sort of thing. If a third-party originator originates maybe a CRA qualifying loan and J.P. Morgan purchases that loan under a purchase sale agreement, would that be something that J.P. Morgan can claim on, you know, a credit for under their CRA commitments?
The CRA value of a purchased loan is, under the CRA regulations, is no different than the CRA exam value of a loan that we originate ourselves. And the reason that that is the case, based on my understanding and experience in working in this, is that purchasing loans, in particular mortgage loans, by and large is a normal part of a large lender's way of doing business, particularly in some of the smaller markets where credit is not as readily available. So using correspondent banks, if you will, as a source of origination in lieu of or in addition to your own sales force. And those types of correspondent lending agreements, which are reflected in an institution's HMDLAR, Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, loan application register, the LAR, are reflected as purchases. But those types of lending arrangements are done for loans across all income spectrums for both borrowers and communities. It's not CRA specific.
Right, right. No, and I certainly didn't mean to suggest that it was. I wasn't 100% sure on some of this stuff, and I just wanted to get clarification from you to the extent that I could. If J.P. Morgan were to purchase CRA qualifying loans like that and get credit for them, and then securitize them in MBS and sell them off, would the purchasing bank then also qualify?
Are you asking if the purchasing bank could get CRA credit for that?
Right.
Yes, they could get credit for that, but if it's in a security, it's not a whole loan, so they would get the credit as an investment. They've made an investment in a security.
Okay. And I guess what the thinking is that it's freed you up to do additional because you're not holding it in portfolio, or do I not have that clear?
You have it partway clear, I would say. For some, not generally for J.P. Morgan Chase, since we don't portfolio very many loans, we sell most of our loans into the secondary market, holding loans on our books is not an issue for us. But for a smaller bank who has capital concerns, keeps things on their portfolio, being able to sell them does allow them to free up capital so they can continue to lend.
Okay.
So part of what J.P. Morgan Chase does in buying loans from smaller entities is actually increase the flow of capital.
Mm. All right. So I think I had a question on here, but I think you answered it. I was looking at some Bear Stearns and WaMu commitments that they had prior to acquisition, and I was going to ask whether they would help you qualify for towards your CRA commitments, and I imagine they would.
I can't really answer that because I'm not clear on what types of commitments or what you're speaking out with Bear Stearns or...
Yeah, I know. I can remember off the top of my head that I guess I was looking at a release that WaMu had an existing $375 billion 10-year commitment towards loans in certain census tracts and whatnot that were would meet CRA goals.
I'm not sure.
Victor, okay. This is Jay Balachek. I don't know if you're aware of this, but you know, we came to WaMu through the FDIC, and it was an asset purchase.
Right.
So it's a different circumstance. I don't know. I mean, it would be a discussion for other folks as to what, if anything, transferred through the federal government when we purchased those assets.
Okay.
I also not sure. I mean, I've been sitting here a little bit confused because it seems at times like you're equating agreements with the legal structure surrounding CRA as if they're always precisely the same thing.
Okay.
And
well, yes, and let me say it's a lack of knowledge on my part. So I've got Ron Borzakowski, an economist, sitting across from me, and he cringes occasionally at some of these. So I apologize for my lack of knowledge on that.
No need. I mean, it's obviously the purpose of doing this, I was getting a little confused, but
yeah.
He was much more the expert.
I apologize, and it's certainly in order to get the amount of work done, I won't make apologies, but I will give you a little explanation. In order to get the amount of work done we've been asked to do, we move at a fast rate here. So I'm not always prepared for these interviews as I'd like to be.
So if I could just clarify, we did not acquire or succeed to any so-called CRA agreement that WaMu had was a party to.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. I understand from talking to my community advocate the other day, I'll pass along his statistic. He said that 98% of banks, there's a 98% pass rate on CRA exams, and he suggested that maybe the test for these CRA exams was not sufficiently rigorous. I would imagine, Ms. Wingard, that being responsible for these exams, you would have an opinion about that. Do you feel that the standards are rigorous?
The CRA exam, I would say yes, is quite rigorous. It does entail a very in-depth look at the performance of Chase over the exam cycle.
Okay.
In all of its different markets.
Could you walk me through what you do to prepare for that for one of those exams briefly, and maybe what your regulator looks at?
Sure. The CRA exam consists of a three-part test. 50% of the test is the lending test, under which they evaluate mortgage lending, small business lending, and community development lending. The second test is the investment test, which accounts for 25% of the score, and which for JP Morgan Chase largely consists of activity in the form of investment in low-income housing tax credits, new market tax credits, some equity investments in companies that serve lower-income communities, or CRA eligible philanthropy. The third test is the services test, the overwhelming majority of which is focused on retail banking services, that is, branch locations and services, and then the remainder of which is focused on, a tiny portion of which is around community development services, which is really more the human element of providing things like home buyer counseling, basic financial education, counseling to people facing foreclosure, or serving on boards or committees with nonprofits who are trying to provide financial services related programming in their local communities. So a three-part test, 50% weighted on lending, 25% on investment and services. Preparation for the exam is on a day-to-day, week-to-week basis, year after year after year, in working with the data and analyzing our performance across our broad footprint and how we're doing in having a proportion of our activities in each of those categories distributed across lower moderate income communities or to lower moderate income borrowers, and working with our line of business partners on a monthly basis against how the metrics are looking, what initiatives we have in place, etc. And a part of that preparation is also having the folks that we have in the local communities on the field, whether they be the relationship managers on my team or people within the various lines of business, talking to people proactively, people from not-for-profits, customers, etc., and understanding the needs and putting some thoughtful, going through a thoughtful process on how well are we responding to those needs, or identifying opportunities for us not to be responsive but to be proactive in helping to meet the needs of these communities or customers the way we would with any other customer segment.
Okay. I suspect I know your answer to this, but I'm going to ask, do you see CRA noncompliance as a threat to potential future merger and acquisition activity?
JPMorgan Chase has a long-standing history of outstanding CRA ratings, and so I don't see it as a threat for JPMorgan Chase at all, because we run CRA the way we do anything else, and that is with the intent of doing it as well as we possibly can.
Okay. Okay. I'm looking at the, Ms. Carey was good enough to send bio information along, and I'm looking at Miss Wingard's bio, and it says that in your current role, you focus on strategy for serving LMI communities. What are some of your current strategies?
Well, strategies include trying to meet or exceed a variety of benchmarks as defined in the CRA regulations, which give us an indication as to how well we're meeting the needs. So, for example, to try and meet or exceed industry performance on the percentage of our loans that go to borrowers who are low income or moderate income. So we look at the HMDA data, for example, which is released by the FFIEC every year, and try to meet or exceed the percentage of our mortgage loans that the industry provides to LMI. And when we think that that is an unregional benchmark, to understand why, so that we can explain why we don't think that's the appropriate course of action or an achievable course of action.
Okay. Reading down further, I see CRA performance analysis. What performance would be analyzed? I know earlier you mentioned that you had four employees, 25 people that basically participate in data analysis. What data are they analyzing?
We're analyzing our own performance in the categories that I described are part of the exam test, so the lending investment service, and the subcategories that comprise this test, against both demographic benchmarks that are aligned with whatever the category of activity would be. So the demographic benchmarks largely come from things like census data in terms of the distribution of population across income categories or things like that, DMV data, the distribution of businesses across geographies of different income categories, et cetera. So against the variety of benchmarks that are built into the CRA regulations that are considered, we also analyze our performance against publicly available HMDA data or small business data or other things. And then we also analyze our performance as it aligns up to market opportunity, the way that we perhaps do other types of research beyond using census or DMV or industry data, doing research on what the opportunities are in a market, and that gives us an indication of potential trends or of strategies. If it's a high unemployment community, that's a variable that we would take into consideration in saying, how does our performance look?
Okay. I have a couple of questions. I received your response, or J.P. Morgan's response, through the Paul Weiss attorneys to some interrogatories regarding CRA that we had put forward. And I just had a couple of clarifying questions on some of that. Ms. Carey, do you have a copy of it there, or I could just cite what I'm questioning?
We have a copy here, yes.
Oh, excellent, excellent. I page 10 of your response, there's a nice chart. It says, it's headed, it says CRA, Chicago CRA Coalition. And
yeah.
I discussed it with Mr. Borzakowski beforehand, and he suggested some answers to my questions, but I just wanted to get J.P. Morgan's clarification. Under the max column, it says FICO max column. I see some scores in there that are in excess of 900.
And, yeah,
and being a neophyte, you know, I think a Fair Isaac score is topping out at 850. Could you explain how you have scores in excess of 850 there?
No, I cannot. We would have to go back to our credit risk people who pull the data from our various databases and ask that question.
Okay. Okay. I also and this is, you know, I'm just looking for clarifying information to the extent you can give it. So I appreciate it. And if you like, you could get that back to us, to Mr. Bondi, from Ms. Carey, or any of the Paul Weiss attorneys. That would be great.
Okay.
Additionally, I just had a question. It seems like the average FICO scores there are rather high, well, some of them well in excess of 700. Is that fairly, it seems, you know, some of these, it seems like they average about the mid-600s, but is that fairly consistent with the character of J.P. Morgan's CRA loans?
So, again, I am not able to answer that question, because as we manage our CRA program, from my seat being responsible for CRA compliance and strategy, we don't view a loan made to a lower moderate income person or a lower moderate income community as in a separate bucket than a loan made to someone with a slightly higher income or a significantly higher income.
Okay.
So, and my role is not as we manage our CRA program, we don't manage it based on kind of FICO scores and this kind of data that you're looking for. That's a part of simply how the business is run, and these loans are a part of our overall business, our overall book of business.
Okay.
Victor, can I suggest that we go back and just double-check our numbers? Because we, as I think we said in our letter, we tried our best, and we'll just go back and verify the information and see if we can give you any more information about the numbers.
Okay. Mr. Borzakowski was good enough to give me a possible answer that's pretty simple and whatnot, and I suspect that yours will probably match his. I wanted to get it from you rather than in-house. So yeah, that.
Can I ask what his suggestion is, just so we know, because that might save us some time too.
Sure.
So, I had two. One is simply data errors, because I've seen this in other data sets that have, you know, other loan origination data sets that have FICO. I've seen lots of times where the FICO score is just either above 850 or invalid or missing or something else. So there's always the it's just typed wrong or something else. The other is that it's possible that at least for some of these loans, people are using Vantage scores or other credit scores that are not FICO scores per se. And I would suspect those would be typed into the same field. So while Fair Isaacs caps out at 850, I do know that there are a couple of other vendors on the market that cap out at 950.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. That's helpful. We'll look into it.
Okay. That's pretty much all I have, I believe. Ms. Dubas, do you have any questions?
No.
Okay. I'll tell you what. I'm prepared to terminate. Before I do, usually I ask confidentiality. The commission doesn't release any information without a vote of the board or at least the chair and the co-chair agreeing, and we ask that our witnesses don't discuss topics presented to them outside, of course, counsel.
Understood.
Okay, thank you. I've got 10:24, and I'm going to turn the recorder off at this point.